And welcome to Crypto Facto with Josh Klayman. I'm your host, Josh, from the global law firm Linklaters. On this podcast, you'll hear hot takes from me and sometimes from special guests on some of the hottest topics affecting the digital assets and tech spaces. Of course, these are our personal views only, and nothing said here constitutes legal advice, investment advice, or any other kind of advice, but we still think it's interesting. So hold on tight and let's get to it. Welcome back, everyone. We're here today on Crypto Facto. I'm Josh Klayman, and I'm here with my amazing colleague, Jeff Cohen. Jeff, you want to say hi?
Hi, Josh. Great to be with you. Great to be back on the podcast. As always, lots of developments to talk about, lots of things going on in the crypto world, and looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You were great last time. I'm excited for this episode. So since we last spoke, a lot has happened. And in fact, a lot has happened just in the past week or so, including, let's see, an earthquake, an eclipse. I mean, we've seen actually the comeuppance in many ways for a couple of the most high-flying figures in digital assets as of just a couple of years ago. For example, we saw recently the conviction of Do Kwon, the mastermind behind Terra Luna, be convicted. And we also have seen now the sentencing just very recently of Sam Bankman-Fried himself. So with that, I know there's a lot to unpack. Also, other things we're going to cover today include some impact litigation and how the industry is really fighting back and taking a proactive stance, going on the offense with respect to certain regulators. So a lot to cover there. Maybe we'll start with Sam Bankman-Fried. Now, if I remember back just a few years ago, I recall being on a stage and someone asking the question, is SBF the new JP Morgan? Because at the time, he was sort of the lender of last resort for a lot of projects, including BlockFi and others that were suffering some difficulties. And of course, there was the very well-publicized fall in November of 2022 of FTX. And many of us, including, I think, probably Jeff, both you and I were discussing it in real time as we saw aspects of it unfolding on what was then known as Twitter.
Yeah, so I've become a little bit of a Sam Bankman-Fried news junkie lately. First of all, you know, I was my initial reaction when FTX collapsed was, what are they going to do about the Major League Baseball umpires' uniforms that they had plastered FTX all over on every single one, for the very good reason, as Sam Bankman-Fried pointed out, that every single pitch you see the umpire and the FTX is just right in your face, and it's great. And then I just recently and a little belatedly read Michael Lewis's book on SBF, and can't recommend it highly enough. A lot of people criticize the book for Lewis's being sort of in Bankman-Fried's pocket and being too much of an advocate for Sam Bankman-Fried. And it's true that he comes out pretty well in the book. It's a fascinating read. And among the many things to think about is, you know, certainly from a lawyer's point of view, I want to drop 2 points about Sam Bankman-Fried. First of all, in many respects, although maybe not in the biggest respects, he was a compliance freak, and he was so afraid of the US and the SEC that he was actually, you know, much more hesitant than many of his colleagues. This was part of his dispute with Binance, was he felt that Binance was insufficiently attentive to compliance issues. And he was, at least for part of the time, he wanted to be the king of compliance. Anyway, that obviously didn't work out that well. The other point about that I keep wondering about with Bankman-Fried is, this is obviously a pretty severe sentence.
It's 25 years, right?
It's 25 years. I think most calculations show that if he behaves himself very well, it could be as little as 12 years. But still, that's a long time for anybody. And somewhat paradoxically, this is a great thing for crypto, because what it does is it sends a signal to potential miscreants and people who would commit fraud in the crypto space that the price may be very high. And of course, that message also goes to potential investors, and they can at least take some solace from the notion that the cop is on the beat and that people who take advantage of the relative lack of regulation in crypto might pay a real price for it. And that's comforting to investors and should be encouraging to them. So I think the tale of Sam Bankman-Fried, fascinating story. Lots of morals out of it. So the moral of the story is, don't commit fraud. And that actually the cops are on the beat. And I think that's actually a really good thing for the crypto community.
Yes. And I should say, it's on my list of reading that I would like to do, but I have not read the book, nor have we been compensated, nor have we been in contact with the author, just in case anyone thinks we're doing a commercial here. But the really interesting thing is, it was reported before FTX tumbled that, and all of the, the bad acts were uncovered, that that the author had been embedded with Sam Bankman-Fried and was basically planning to do this all along. It just sort of happened.
He was totally in the, so to speak, right place at the right time. He was indeed deeply far along in the book when the collapse happened. And those things tend to happen with Michael Lewis. He's a very fortunate man in that sense.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things, other than, I don't know if there's a relative lack of regulation for digital assets, your mileage may vary for those who are listening. But I think one thing I absolutely agree with you, Jeff, is that this is a great thing for the industry. The fact that we have this behind us, and that now, we, as you said, a message has been sent, and now, it really, the events of 2022 are in the rearview mirror. Now, on one hand, one may say, and some do say, look, how bad was it really? To which I would say very bad. But some say, well, look, the investors, the customers are getting their money back. But also we should just point out, they might be getting their dollars back, right? For the dollarized digital assets they had. But they may very well want their digital assets back, which is a tale as old as crypto, right? Going back, maybe not as old as crypto, but certainly to Mt. Gox many, many years ago, where there was a big discussion about whether people got their Bitcoin or whether they'd get the dollarized version, or I suppose the Japanese equivalent of that calculation. And so as we move forward, though, we are seeing now, and normally we don't talk about price action, but I think it is relevant to say, and this is not investment advice, Bitcoin has reached new highs, like really overwhelmingly new highs, and levels that we haven't seen in years. And I think, we're seeing a lot of the traditional financial firms who may have been tiptoeing into this space a few years ago, but then, may have pulled back a little because of basically the contagion and the continued bankruptcies that we were hearing about. Whereas now, a lot of them are really moving forward in a meaningful way, and things that have been ideas and projects that have been on the sidelines or in people's heads are beginning to take shape. And I think one of the things that leads us into, before we get to impact litigation and things like that, really is the spot Bitcoin ETF. And maybe we can talk about this spot Ether ETF on the horizon. So as I think folks who are listening know, after long fought, hard battles including the Grayscale case against the SEC, which led a federal judge to conclude that the SEC had acted arbitrarily and capriciously in denying the spot Bitcoin ETF, because essentially the arguments that the SEC was making, they were all arguments that were correlated to the Bitcoin futures, which were approved years ago, right? So there was no non-correlating reason for denying the spot Bitcoin ETF. And in many ways, as we've talked about previously, the SEC's hand was forced, right, to approve it. So now we're in a new stage. And I will say, you know, the spot Bitcoin ETFs, despite, you know, things that have been reported, including that, you know, Bitcoin miners were seeking liquidity, so there were some sell-offs as the ETFs launched. There also have been selling of assets by a lot of the debtors that are in bankruptcy, right? So those assets that they're holding, this has downward pressure on the price of Bitcoin. And still, and also Grayscale, shares of Grayscale have been being sold off, but still the price of Bitcoin and the demand for Bitcoin has been growing. And we just saw just in the past few days that BlackRock, which is one of the leaders among several in these spot Bitcoin ETFs, added a number of authorized participants, and now they're up to 9. And some of those include really big name financial institutions that previously were saying, you know what, there's no value in crypto. And so it seems that folks are really turning the page. And the next thing that people are looking to, in many cases, is the spot Ether ETF. At the same time, we're seeing pressures going against that, right? We've seen letters from 2 senators to Gary Gensler, including by Senator Reid, right? Saying, essentially, we urge you not to approve any more spot crypto ETFs. We've also seen the announcement of an investigation, apparently by the SEC, into the Ethereum Foundation. Now, it's important for folks to remember that the Ethereum Foundation did its ICO in 2014, so a long time ago. But more recently, in connection with the merge, or prior to the merge, where there was a movement from proof of work mining, for example, like similar to Bitcoin, to proof of stake system, people were staking their ETH, and the proof of stake system wasn't yet up and running. The merge hadn't occurred yet. And Gary Gensler had very publicly said that he thought that that might look like lending. So it's unclear exactly what the SEC may be investigating, or even what dates as of which they're sending questions or whatever they're doing. Nevertheless, some believe that this could be the SEC's way of trying to come up with a justification for delaying or denying a spot Ether ETF that does not correlate to Ether futures. Because as we know, last year, the SEC approved Ether futures. And I think that's something to think about. Many people thought, okay, well, that ship has sailed, now people can move on. But there are a lot of questions, including what it means to have if we were to have a spot Ether ETF, how does that work with respect to governance? How does that work with respect to staking? What if there is another hard fork? Of course, things like hard forks could come up in Bitcoin as well, but lots of questions on the horizon. That was a little sidebar, a bit unplanned to go into, and maybe now I'll loop you back in, Jeff, since you're very patiently listening to me go on and on about that, kind of excitedly. One thing I know you've been excited about, I think, since even before many in the market were calling this, I remember you talking about the major questions doctrine when we were hearing about it in connection with climate. And you were saying, hey, this might actually work in the digital asset space. And we have seen it now raised in numerous defenses to SEC enforcement actions, including in the Southern District, including in cases like SEC v. Doquan Terraform Labs, which Judge Rakoff presided over, as well as certain other judges, including Judge Fela And others have begun addressing this. Do you wanna kick off on this?
Sure. I mean, look, it obviously there's just a lot of uncertainty. We all know that crypto has been living with legal uncertainty throughout its existence, and there continues to be uncertainty. And while the chips are stacking up against most of these arguments, and we're seeing district courts, particularly in the Southern District of New York, generally align against the there has to be a contract argument, as well as
When you say there has to be a contract argument, I think what you're talking about, just for listeners who might not be following our minds, is in the context of the Howey test and whether there exists an investment contract. Of course, the questions are whether there's an investment of money in a common enterprise with a reasonable expectation of profit based solely or primarily on the managerial or entrepreneurial efforts of others. And there has been an argument that one element also would be a written contract. Sorry, back to you, Doug.
Which makes sense because it has the word contract in there, but I think courts have been, but then the Howey test itself doesn't use the word contract. And so I think courts have been a little confused, as they probably ought to be, about whether there needs to be a contract. Or can you have an investment contract without a contract? Only a lawyer could invent an investment contract without a contract. But that seems to be right. Yeah. So that seems to be where things are shaking out. And I think that the courts are generally, with some exceptions, not requiring a contract. And in general, the courts are going the same way on the major questions doctrine. What is the major questions doctrine? The major questions doctrine, as articulated by the Supreme Court in EPA versus West Virginia, basically says that at some point when a regulator is going to embark on a new area of regulation, which affects a very large and substantial portion of the economy, they go just by definition beyond the bounds of what Congress could have authorized or could have meant to authorize in that agency's authorizing legislation. The major question doctrine goes along with, and somewhat parallel to, what is sometimes referred to as Chevron deference, the case being the Chevron case from the 1980s, where the Supreme Court held that in judging what the extent of a regulator's power was, courts should be deferential to agencies who have greater expertise in their subject area. Both of those doctrines. So Chevron is clearly under attack. It has been under attack in dicta in several recent Supreme Court opinions, and we will get a more fulsome review of Chevron in before the summer, and the betting is definitely in favor of Chevron deference being basically abolished and courts reviewing determinations of regulators' authority de novo, without deference.
Why is it being abolished? Like, what's driving this?
Well, in your view? Yeah, it depends. Of course, with any legal doctrine, it depends a little bit how cynical you are. There is obviously an anti-regulatory thrust on the Supreme Court. The justices appointed in the prior administration, and Justice Thomas and Justice Alito are frankly quite suspicious of regulators, and frankly feel that the regulatory apparatus in this country has lost its tether in the congressional mandate.
No pun intended for a crypto podcast.
Correct. And that basically regulators need to... that regulators have gone off on their own without congressional mandates to do so, and that Chevron deference has exacerbated that trend, and that that needs to be rolled back. So it's all about, to use a phrase used in some quarters, rolling back the regulatory state. The major questions doctrine is a close cousin of the sort of anti-Chevron movement. And the major questions doctrine, as I said, basically says that before a regulator embarks on a new area of regulation, it needs to, I almost want to say check its privilege. It needs to check its mandate, and it and courts need to look at whether Congress has clearly mandated this regulator to regulate this large sector of the economy. That challenge to the SEC's enforcements in the crypto space has so far not had much success in the district courts. I believe there is a roughly 50% chance that that will change a lot at either the appellate or even Supreme Court level. And the way I look at that is just to say, what would the Supreme Court do if confronted with this question today? And like I said, I think there's at least a 50% chance that they would say that this is a new area of the economy, that in a very, very large area of the economy, that Congress has not expressly subjected to regulation by the SEC, and the SEC can't regulate it, and that would include enforcement actions, unless and until Congress gives it a clearer mandate to do so.
So what's really interesting about what you're saying is, you know, how, I guess, well, part of it is, how do we get it up to the Supreme Court level, which we'll go into in a second, right? What some of the strategy might be. But also, how big does it have to be? Because I think what we've been hearing in some of the cases is some comparisons to different industries, which some believe might not actually be apples to apples comparisons, or where actually the digital asset space may actually be larger.
Yeah, it's actually, I mean, the Biden loan, student loan forgiveness program was estimated, I believe, at $400 billion and was struck down under the major questions doctrine. And in fact, the crypto space is bigger than that. So I just don't see how one can say that this is not a major sector of the economy that the SEC is seeking to regulate. So if you buy the major questions doctrine, and we clearly have to, like I said, at best, it's a 50-50 shot. I think there's a very good chance that certainly if it gets before the Fifth Circuit, and if it ultimately gets to the Supreme Court, you could see that having a significant purchase on the SEC's regulation of the crypto industry.
Yeah, and in certain cases, I mean, in one case, Senator Lummis actually participated in the creation of an amicus brief saying, look, Congress really is contemplating this right now. And that wasn't deemed by that particular judge to be enough in that instance. But I think with the passage of time, and we'll get to the Fifth Circuit in 1 second, but just one of the things I think about is, okay, look at the size of the digital asset space now and look at what Congress is doing now. When we, assuming we get an appeal, we get an appeal to the Supreme Court ultimately, how big will the industry be then? And what will Congress have done? Now, I guess a question, I don't know the answer to this, and Jeff, you may or you may not, so I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'll just ask it anyway, is at that point, if this question is appealed to the Supreme Court, will they look then at the time, at the size of the industry and what Congress is doing as of the time of that appeal, or will they look back to the time of the trial decision? That's one thing I don't know. I want to check about after, unless you know, Jeff.
Doesn't matter. It's huge. We know there are trillions in the crypto space.
Fair.
So, you know, I'm not sure that that decision as to which time you look at is going to make that much of a difference.
That makes sense. Okay, so moving over to the Fifth Circuit and, you know, the Northern District of Texas, there have been some litigations filed, you know, against the SEC. And those include one by a digital asset issuer. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but I believe it's called Beba. And then also a trading platform in a separate case called LedgeLex. And these two cases both try to raise the same sort of issues and questions, including about due process, including about major questions and things like that, but also are basically trying to say, look, we need to know, SEC, that we're not doing anything wrong. So really, rather than what's happened up to this point where the SEC has gotten to choose the facts of the cases that it wants to bring, figure out where to bring the cases, and we've seen them bring them many things strategically on similar topics in different districts, whether it be the Southern District, DC District, or Northern District of California, or others. Here, the industry, someone in the industry has been quoted as saying, we don't want to be sitting ducks, right? And really, really taking the initiative to reframe the narrative and get some law on the books that favors the industry. That would be good for the plaintiffs in those cases, but it also, Jeff, could result in appeals and could result in different determinations in different circuits. So you could have a different result in the Fifth Circuit that could cause the appeal that you were talking about.
Yeah, so there's obviously forum shopping going on, and the SEC is trying to bring as many cases in the Southern District of New York as it can. And the industry, it's true that basically, absent this Declaratory Judgment Act, these Declaratory Judgment Act cases that they're bringing in Texas, until now, they've been completely subject to the whims, as it will, of the SEC, and wherever the SEC brings the case is where the defendants had to defend. The idea of a few firms in Texas is the same thing that a lot of, you know, very, you know, hot button political issue groups have done, which is to choose these single judge districts in Texas, get a favorable ruling. This is how the abortion drug got banned on a nationwide basis. So here, if they can use the Declaratory Judgment Act to get a favorable judgment, then get up to the Fifth Circuit, maybe get a favorable judgment there, and have that sitting out there next to what one can predict would be the Second Circuit, having a less less favorable, you know, having a less favorable judgment relative to the question whether tokens are securities generally, and then cause the circuit split that way, and that gets it up to the Supreme Court. We're still talking about years. This is not going to happen rapidly, but there is definitely a lot of litigation and courtroom drama to be played out here. And of course, Congress can always fix it. I mean, if Congress acts, the whole thing is over. But I don't think anyone has any real confidence that that can happen in any, you know, in any foreseeable time frame.
So I absolutely hear you, although I think folks are working hard to get some kind of federal stablecoin legislation and, you know, the FIT 21 Act or certain other things across the line. We'll see, especially in an election year, what happens. And of course, you know, depending on what happens in the election year, as you noted, this process could go on for years and years, and there could be different folks at the heads of these agencies. I guess it remains to be seen whether Chair Gensler of the SEC will remain at the helm. And yeah, so there's a lot with that. I do think that it's important to remember for those listening, you know, just as in the case of a default judgment, right? You may get a certain decision where there was no one fighting back against it. And that's not going to have the same precedential value as, you know, another type of case where there really is the kind of legal volleying and the process, you know, taking place. Similarly, and, you know, caveat, of course, I'm not a litigator. Similarly, if you look at the decisions that have come up, for example, in the Southern District, as we pointed out in prior podcasts, you know, those decisions are not binding on other judges, including other judges in the same district. So we had Judge Torres, we have Judge Rakoff, we have Judge Fela, and various other decisions, many of which may be appealed down the line. But as the cases keep coming, as Jeff said, this could take years because all of these decisions, while judges may decide to follow another judge or not, or come up with different reasoning, it's not binding. And so definitely, Jeff, as we were discussing in a different context, nothing is the final word yet. It's important to remember that bad facts make bad law. And this goes to the point about the SEC bringing very strategic cases, whether they may be low-hanging fruit because they involve fraud or something like that. What we have to remember about the Southern District is that these judges, you know, some of them quite influential, including Judge Rakoff, who is, you know, a master of the securities bar, or bench, rather, I guess the case is, as the case may be. But when we think about the cases that have recently come up there, SEC v. Do Kwon Terraform Labs, right? With Do Kwon also being, you know, criminally convicted, right? Similarly, we just saw, as we talked about at the beginning of this, Sam Bankman-Fried, convicted in the Southern District of New York, right? Having gone before the same judge who many, many years ago was in charge of sentencing for Silk Road. So I think, you know, as we think about what's shaping this, the SEC is definitely, in my view, and as you noted as well, has definitely been strategic. And now the industry is as well. And we've seen, you know, victories, including as was talked about earlier with Grayscale, you know, which led to the spot Bitcoin ETF launch and boom, really. But we've also seen the SEC be sanctioned, right, in the DebtBox case. And I think that is really an important thing to call out. The SEC in that case requested a TRO, right? They said that DebtBox was moving an enormous amount of money outside of the US. As it turned out, that payment wasn't going outside of the US. And also, DebtBox didn't even know it was being investigated. So lo and behold, the SEC came to know this in one form or another, or at least certain staff did, and did not fully disclose and fully make clear that this had been a mistake. And there's many more things, but this all had a very bad effect on DebtBox and its business. Sanctions were brought against the SEC. The SEC, or a motion for sanctions was brought. The SEC fought back and said, look, you know, we're instituting trainings so this doesn't happen again. We're also, you know, we think it's enough just to have the case dismissed without prejudice, meaning that they could bring it again, conceivably. But instead, the judge in that case said, in a scathing, something like 80-page decision, that sanctions would be awarded against the SEC, and in fact, the SEC would pay DebtBox's legal fees. So I think some of this, we'll see whether this has an impact on the mood of the SEC or the care with which cases are brought or the allegations are made. But certainly, I think it is unusual to have sanctions brought against the SEC. And perhaps this impact litigation, you know, as a form of 3D chess, may move the conversation in a direction that isn't dominated by the regulator. So Jeff, before we wrap up for the day, and thanks again for joining, is there anything that you'd like to say just as a takeaway for those listening?
Look, I mean, these are very, you know, the Chinese proverb is may you not live in interesting times. These are interesting times for the crypto industry. There are a lot of shoes left to fall, and we'll have to see where we go. There will remain a great deal of uncertainty, and that's regrettable and unfortunate, but that's just where we are. And I think we all have to live with that uncertainty. and be grateful for the good news in crypto, which you pointed to, and there continues to be a lot of it.
Crypto keeps rising like a phoenix, despite having been declared dead many, many times. So
thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
And there you have it, our hot takes for today. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Josh from Linklaters. Join us next time on Crypto Facto with Josh Klayman.